Good morning, everybody. Really, really lovely to be with you here today. My name is Ben Askew. I'm a member of Grace Church, and I've been invited to share something of God's Word with you today. So I'm really glad you're able to join me, whether you are a regular in our community or whether you are visiting us for the first time. It's great to share this with you because today is the start of Advent. That's right, I did say Advent, because despite what those horrible chocolate calendars might want to tell us, Advent doesn't have to start on the 1st of December. It can start at the end of November, just as it is this year. And the reason is because Advent traditionally features the four Sundays leading up to Christmas. And Advent means arrival, and obviously the arrival we're talking about is the arrival of Jesus, the Messiah. And I want to think about expectations today, specifically the expectations of the people of the Old Testament, the expectations they had about this coming Messiah, the Messiah who was going to arrive. Now, an expectation is essentially a prediction that we make about something that's about to happen. And it can be something we do consciously, or such as if someone asks us about the outcome of a sporting event or a film we're about to watch, or unconsciously, like when we put our car keys in our ignition, for example. And these expectations are formed around the information we have available to us and how we interpret that information, how we understand it. And sometimes that information can be good, our interpretation, our understanding of that information can be good, and therefore we can be pretty confident in our expectations. Sometimes that information can be bad, particularly if we're given over to making lots of assumptions. Assumptions are when we accept something as being factual without really testing it or thinking it through or researching it in any kind of meaningful way. And some people have pointed out that that does sound a little bit like faith and belief, really, to sort of say something's true without really knowing that it is. There's a hint of truth in that, but that's really an oversimplification, because faith really doesn't have to be ill thought through or poorly researched or without evidence and logic. Sometimes it can, but it doesn't have to be blind. Assumptions, though, always are blind, and they can lead us to make some really silly conclusions that can actually mess up our expectations, and we can end up in a place where our expectations are not met, and we can be confused and even disappointed. And that's one of the things about expectations, that they're not perfect, they're not certain. And the reason for that is because we're not omniscient, we're not all-knowing, and therefore the information we have is not perfect. Therefore, for all the expectations we might form, there's always a hint of unpredictability and doubt. That's not a bad thing. In that way, expectations require an element of faith in order for us to accept them as being meaningful, and that's not a bad thing, because that unpredictability makes life interesting. You know, we talked about our expectations not being met and how disappointing that is, but when our expectations are exceeded, that is amazing. And Advent really is a time of expectation and anticipation. Anticipation as the emotions that accompany an expectation. They can be good, they can be hopeful, they can be exciting, or they can be negative, they can be dreadful and apprehensive. For the people of the Old Testament, their expectations of the Messiah would have been exciting. They would have been hopeful, and that is precisely the message we get coming from the Old Testament prophecies about the coming Messiah. And we look at those, we reflect on those at this time of year for this precise reason. And as a result, we are going to be looking at Isaiah for the next couple of weeks. Isaiah, one of the most important of all the prophets. His book is certainly the longest book of prophecy. And it's good value for money, because it contains a lot of prophecies about the Messiah. And some of them are the most vivid and important that we have. So today I want to look at that passage. I want to ask the question about why we believe Jesus fulfills this passage. And some of those reasons are going to be fairly clear-cut. Some of them might seem a little bit confusing. But we're going to explore that together. And before we get there, I want to read this passage. It's from Isaiah chapter 9, verses 1 to 7. But there will be no gloom for those who were in anguish. In the former time he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun, the land of Naphtali. But in the latter time he will make glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who lived in a land of deep darkness, on them light has shined. You have multiplied the nation. You have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as people exult when dividing plunder. For the yoke of their burden and the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. For all the boots of the tramping warriors and the garments rolled in blood shall be burned as fuel for the fire. For a child has been born for us, a son given to us. Authority rests upon his shoulders, and he is named Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. His authority shall grow continually, and there shall be endless peace for the throne of David and his kingdom. He will establish and uphold it with justice and with righteousness, and from this time onwards and forevermore, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. Now that is one of the most famous of all prophecies about the Messiah. It's the one that we frequently read at this time of year. And it's worth going into a little bit of background about this chap, Isaiah, before we go any further. He's a really interesting figure. He lived at the end of the 8th century BC and the beginning of the 7th century BC, so roughly about 3,000 years ago, just shy of. And he lived in Jerusalem. He was a member of a priestly caste. His family were members of the priestly caste, and therefore reasonably high up within the society of the day, and as a result he had access to the ruling classes. And it's here that he encounters a lot of injustice and corruption, and this becomes a recurring theme throughout his work, lamenting the exploitation of the poor and the corruption of kings and priests and politicians. And he describes a judgment that God is going to place upon Israel because of these sins. And he describes how this judgment will take the form of an invasion from foreign powers, specifically the Assyrian Empire and then eventually the Babylonians. And this is precisely what happens to Israel. At the time, it was divided into a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. And then the north is invaded by the Assyrians. And the southern kingdom, in order to survive, in order to avoid being conquered, it has to pay tribute. So this is a dark time for the Israelites. And Isaiah interprets this as a judgment upon the corruption that he has witnessed. But despite this bleakness, and we see elements of that in this passage, there's a perpetual theme of hope running throughout his book. And our passage is a really good example of that. For while it does talk about people walking in darkness, they have also seen a great light. And what's the reason for this hope? Well, it's the coming Messiah. And the Messiah is a Hebrew word. It means anointed one. And it refers to a figure that God is going to send from the line of King David. David, the great hero king of the Old Testament, who presides over the beginning of Israel's golden age. And this Messiah, he will be a rescuer, a salvation for his people. And Isaiah describes this in very vivid language. He talks about how the people are going to be rejoicing because the yoke of their burden has been broken. The rod of their oppressor has been broken. But more than this, the boots of trampling soldiers will be burnt along with bloodied garments. So these people will not just be rescued, their defeat will be overturned. They will be restored. And that's a really powerful image for people who are being conquered by other nations. There's even references to things like Midian. The connection is made there with the figure of Gideon from the Book of Judges, who tackled the enemies of Israel and raised up an army to destroy them. So all this powerful imagery to describe the impact that this Messiah is going to have for the people of Israel, for God's people. And that pretty much sums up the first half of this passage. And then we get to verse 6. And this is really where Isaiah seems to want to describe who this Messiah is going to be. And he starts by talking about this a child being given to us. And immediately a connection is formed with the nativity story, which is fundamentally a story about the birth of an infant. The eagle-eyed amongst you, though, will probably have seen that there's, beyond that, there's not a whole lot of other things referencing that nativity story. There's no reference to Bethlehem or anything like that. But that's okay, because there's still lots of really important things here. In fact, there's some really big and bold statements that Isaiah's making, some really grandiose title, lofty titles that he's ascribing to this Messiah figure. He talks about this Messiah having authority on his shoulders, and he uses four titles which are well known, but they're incredibly grandiose, but at the same time they can seem a little bit confusing, and it's worth unpacking them a little bit here. I mean, it is worth saying that Isaiah, like a lot of other writers in the Bible, has quite a poetic flair, and he likes to use language creatively, and as a result some of the things he talks about have a lot of symbolism imbued into them, and that can make interpreting some of these things a little bit more complicated. Take this phrase, Wonderful Counselor, one of the first of these four big titles that Isaiah gives to the Messiah. Now, what Isaiah really means there is that the Messiah will be wise in counsel. It doesn't literally mean he will be a counselor, someone who gives advice or someone who has legal expertise. He will be wise in counsel. He will have wisdom. And that's an important quality. And then you've got this phrase, Mighty God. He will be someone who is powerful and divine. And then you've got this phrase, Everlasting Father. And it's been suggested that Everlasting Father, fatherhood generally, has a close connection with this idea of protection. And therefore, this Messiah will be an eternal protector of his people. And then you get this phrase, Prince of Peace. Now, this is a pretty well-known title. In fact, Grace Church, in years gone by, possibly even this year, gives it its Christmas celebrations the title Prince of Peace. So this is very important, very, very well-known, very famous. And what Isaiah seems to be saying is that this messianic figure, this Messiah, will reign in eternal peace. His kingdom will be a peaceful kingdom. And he talks about this kingdom being upheld with justice and righteousness, that the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do all of these things. And that's wonderful. It's a wonderful image about who this Messiah is going to be. But some people have looked at it and critiqued it, really, wondering if actually it kind of matches up with the Jesus we find in the Gospels. Because some of these phrases, as we said, might seem a little bit confusing at first glance. And so it is worth asking why we do believe Jesus fulfills this passage. And the first big clue that we have to that is actually all the way back in verse 1, when he talks about making glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. The Messiah will be Galilean, which is precisely where Jesus does the majority of his teaching. So immediately we've got a connection. And alongside that reference to a child, it seems like we're on pretty solid ground. Although there are some interesting points here. I talked about Wonderful Counselor, I talked about wisdom. That is generally something we can ascribe, we see reflected in the life and ministry of Jesus. He was a rabbi, that's generally the form his ministry took, at least initially. And we have episodes where people are astounded at his wisdom. So we can kind of tick that one off to Jesus. However, there's some other confusing ones. Take this phrase, Everlasting Father. Father is not a name we give to Jesus. We call him the Son. the second part of the Trinity, we call, we reserve the title Father for the first person of the Trinity, and therefore we have God the Father and God the Son. This is one of the confusing yet wonderful parts of the mystery of the Trinity, that Jesus is the Son of the Trinity, but he is also God. And that is part of the belief that we affirm about Jesus. He's also called the Son of God, and this is something that we find in the New Testament. Jesus himself calls him, Jesus calls himself the Son of David, the Son of Man, etc. And there's this wonderful episode where Jesus is being baptized, and a voice comes down from heaven and says, "You are my Son, in whom you are well pleased. You are my Son, in whom I am well pleased." But there's no connection between Jesus and being a, and Father. It's just not a title we use. It's not in the not used really in the Bible. We don't use it in our Christian or theological rhetoric. Where does it come from? What does it mean? I mean, we already talked about how for Isaiah it refers to this idea of an eternal protector, but again, that's not something we really say in reference to Jesus. So that can seem a little bit confusing. And that's not the only aspect here. Some of the others can, on the face of it, seem a little bit confusing as well. I mean, mighty God, well, you know, we affirm Jesus as God, and this is a theme that comes through from the New Testament, particularly the Gospel of John, where we at the end we see the disciple Thomas declaring the risen Jesus to be his Lord and his God. It's a theme that runs throughout the whole of that Gospel, and it's a really important one. But no other Old Testament prophecy really seems to make that connection about the Messiah being divine. And in fact, at the time of Jesus, it was considered a blasphemy to call someone God. And exactly, that's one of the exact charges that are laid at the feet of Jesus. For a lot of people, that was a bit off-putting. It was something that they found difficult to reconcile with their expectations of the Messiah. And then there's this phrase, Prince of Peace. Now, that on the face of it, that might seem to be pretty straightforward. Jesus was a man of peace. We talk about him as such. He was certainly not a man given over to violent conflict. But if you go into the book of Luke, you find a passage where Jesus talks about not bringing peace, but division, which is a remarkable verse and one that really, really threw me when I first read it. It seems to be Jesus admitting that the gospel is going to be so radically challenging for people that many people are not going to be able to accept it, and it's going to cause a real wedge between people who are close. And then others have pointed out that the history of the church, the history of the Christian church, really hasn't been a very peaceful one. And it's also been one with a lot of injustice in either. So this vision of a Messiah who reigns in eternal peace with justice and righteousness, that doesn't really seem to have come to pass. And so some have even suggested, can we really say that Jesus is a Prince of Peace? Does that measure up with the Jesus we know and the church that he has founded? Well, I don't think that that's true. I think there's much more nuance to that, unsurprisingly. And the reason is because of this very simple fact. We are not looking at this from the perspective of the end of the story. We are looking at it from the middle of the story. We can't see the big picture yet, because this story isn't yet finished. So consequently, our understanding and our expectations may not look exactly like the images, these images and these prophecies that were put down centuries ago, 3,000 years ago. And this is something that the people of the New Testament found difficult as well, because there were many different expectations about who this Messiah was going to be, all of them informed by prophecies such as this, but also many, many others. And interpreting those was not an exact science, partly because of the nature of the sort of symbolic and figurative language that was being used, but also because our interpretations and the way we read something is informed by a lot of things which are not necessarily very helpful. Things like, you know, our preconceptions, our values and our assumptions. And this was true for the people in the New Testament and the ancient world. So a lot of people thought the Messiah was going to be a king. Some people thought he was going to be a priest. Some people thought a mishmash between the two. One of the most popular expectations was the fact that the Messiah was going to be a powerful military commander who was going to drive out all of Israel's enemies, just like King David had done. But Jesus didn't really seem to reflect that in any kind of meaningful way. And consequently, people were really, really confused by that. A lot of people were quite sceptical. Consequently, the writers of the New Testament were very, very keen to quote as many pieces of the Old Testament as possible as evidence that Jesus was in fact fulfilling the scriptures and therefore was the Messiah, which is a good tactic to use. However, they also did it in a way which often challenged some of the accepted meanings, interpretations and understandings of those passages. Take this passage from Isaiah chapter 40. A voice cries out, "In the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be lifted up, and every mountain and hill shall be made low, and uneven ground shall become level, and the rough places a plain. Then the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all people shall see it together, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken." Now this is echoed and quoted in the New Testament, specifically in the book of Luke, chapter 3, verses 4 to 6. He says, "The voice of one crying out in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his path straight. Every valley shall be filled, and every fat mountain and hill shall be made low. And the crooked shall be made straight, and the rough ways made smooth, and all flesh shall see the salvation of God." That's the same passage, but rendered in slightly different language, in order to kind of challenge the interpretation and give it a different understanding. Specifically, that Jesus was not just the Messiah for the Jews, but also for everyone, for the entire world. And that's a really important point as well. And the message we take from that is that the gospel wasn't looking to meet people's expectations. Because it is not the job of man to decide who the Messiah should be. Instead, it's the Messiah who gets to show us who he is. Consequently, the gospel is sometimes going to challenge expectations and interpretations. Sometimes it's going to actively defy them. But most of the time, it will exceed them. Jesus is the Messiah who exceeds our expectations, who challenges our understandings in amazing and surprising ways. This is a really important point as we reflect upon our own expectations, because I already said that we're not at the end of this story. I mean, finding a passage in the Old Testament that doesn't seem to match up with the Jesus in the Gospel, well, that would be a problem if we were just thinking about the Jesus of 2,000 years ago. But we're not. We're not thinking about just a figure from history. We're talking about a Jesus who we affirm is still alive, who is present with us, who's going to be present with us tomorrow, the Son of a living God, who is not static and immobile, but vital and dynamic. And what's more, we've been given a promise of that Jesus will return. And so, passages that don't seem to make sense to us now, when we read things about a Prince of Peace, or an everlasting kingdom of righteousness and justice, or an everlasting father, that might not make sense to us now, but it can and will make sense in the future. Because those Old Testament prophecies weren't just about the past. They weren't just about the Old Testament or the New Testament. they're about today, and they will be about tomorrow as well. And that is the leap of faith that we're asked to make here. That is where we're asked to invest our trust, in this promise that these things will come to pass. They will make sense. We will see Jesus fulfilling these passages in their entirety. And as a result, to think about Advent is, we shouldn't be thinking about it as a memorial to things that happened long ago, or people who existed long ago. It is a reminder that this is an unfinished story. There's more to come. There's more to expect. There's more to anticipate. And that's an amazing thing. But we must always, always be prepared to have our expectations challenged and exceeded by a Jesus who is wonderful and surprising. Thank you for joining me today. I'm going to finish with a prayer in a moment, but I want just to say that if I don't see you, have a blessed Advent and Christmas. And thank you once again for being with me here today. Father God, thank you that we've had this time today to explore your word, to explore its breadth, its depth, all the wonderful mysteries that lie within. Thank you for the ways in which it helps form our expectations, but also in how it exceeds them. But mainly thank you that it is a word of hope, that it contains a promise for our future. Help us to remember that this story is not yet over, that your story is not yet over. Help us to remember we have a part to play. In your name, amen. Amen.